This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Hope you had a great weekend. Pleased you're with us. And thanks to First Financial Tax and Accounting Services for providing signature support for our program. In studio to begin is Morgan LaMondre, the legal director for STAR. She's been with us a few times, but it's been a few months now, and much is still happening regarding sexual misconduct. And we'll talk with her about that and more, and it even involves the Louisiana legislature and its views on domestic abuse. 877-217-5757 is your number. 877-217-5757. Talk at talklouisiana.org is our email address. Good morning, Morgan.
Good morning.
6 years as legal director of STAR. And at the end of the legislative session, a fracas on the floor between Representatives Melinda White and Alan Seabaugh over a bill regarding domestic abuse. And the bill was thought to be on its way to passage. And then Representative White, according to witnesses, made a threat to Representative Seabaugh. What's your take on what happened regarding the incident between the two lawmakers and the fact that this bill ultimately was shelved?
Well, I definitely wasn't there to see what happened, but sort of looking at all the news coverage of it and just seeing Twitter and people's comments about it, it does appear that Representative White may have made a comment about going to get her gun. Now, whether or not she directly said she was going to use her gun, I don't know that that's the case. But I think what has happened and what I've witnessed, just the whole process, is that with House Bill 159, everyone kept saying, oh, this bill was meant to take away our guns, and this is, a you know, against our Second Amendment rights, which was not the case. And so I think in conjunction with that and being told she didn't know what she was talking about, she got triggered from what Representative Seabaugh had said, and she had worked very hard on a bill, and I think she said some comments not to threaten, but just, you know, it doesn't excuse her even mentioning the gun, but I think that in the height of all of the emotions and her having a personal experience with domestic abuse certainly caused her to maybe have a reaction that otherwise she would not have.
What would the bill have done?
So essentially, it was a very long bill, 66 pages, that really all of the biggest part of the bill was a new or sort of a concise definition of what domestic abuse was. And I have part of it. One of the things that seemed to be the most controversial was the part where essentially right now we have in various places different definitions, and there are certain parts where it says includes but is not limited to. So right now, technically, you could have certain types of abuse that are not physical in nature, but one of the things that this bill did was create a clean definition of when you could have a certain type of emotional or financial abuse to be eligible for a protection order and not necessarily have to experience physical violence first. And that was so. It says basically any act or threat to act that is intended to coerce, control, punish, intimidate, or exact revenge on the other party for the purpose of preventing the victim from reporting to law enforcement or requesting medical assistance or emergency victim services or from the ability to leave the relationship. So that's very narrow for all of those things to happen. And the saying goes, I mean, for domestic abuse, it doesn't typically start out as physical in nature. It starts out with financial isolation, you know, those types of things, and then it resorts to physical. So the idea is we want victims to be able to get a protection order to get out of the relationship before it escalates to physical violence.
Well, did the fracas between Melinda White and Alan Seabaugh give lawmakers cover in walking away from the bill? Because ultimately, Representative White pulled it, and I think she did so because she didn't have the votes.
Well, I don't know that she didn't have the votes as much as towards the end after it happened. It was a way to not have to maybe address the issue at hand of what happened. I think maybe she did have the votes, but then after things happened, people just didn't really want to deal with the bill anymore.
Domestic violence, as you know firsthand, is a serious issue in our country and in this community, and many of the homicides are now related to that, unfortunately. And anytime it happens, even short of a murder, it's serious business. And And it's usually men, almost universally men, beating up women or threatening women. And the latest high-profile case of an accusation, and at this point the man is charged and deserves at this point the presumption of innocence, is the well-known attorney Peyton Murphy. When something like this happens, when do you get involved?
Well, for STAR, we primarily work with survivors of sexual assault. So they can be in intimate relationships, but we don't necessarily, most of our clients are not necessarily in intimate relationships. We do have times where we do have intimate partner situations. And I will say, once sexual abuse happens, that is one of the highest leading indicators of lethality next to having a gun for when the situation has definitely escalated to the point of where we're really concerned about homicide. So as far as us getting involved in general, I mean, at any point, somebody can call STAR for our services. We have a 24-hour hotline. We have advocates that go to hospitals to accompany survivors for forensic medical exams, accompany survivors to law enforcement or any type of justice accompaniment interviews. And then we do offer free legal representation. And some of, you know, I'd say one of the primary areas is that we do represent survivors in protection order hearings.
877-217-5757. But when it involves a high-profile individual, people are, of course, interested because of the fame or infamy, whatever you want to call it. It can't be ignored, and in some ways it's good that it heightens attention to this, but in other ways it can become a circus. Do you ever comment on cases like this?
I mean, I guess we comment generally. We never acknowledge either way, whether it's high profile or not, if somebody's sought STAR services. But in general, I mean, we typically can comment.
Mm-hmm. Now, when Scott Woodward was with us on March 15th, it's been 3 months and 6 days, he said he was consulting with STAR regarding the LSU problems. Have you been involved in any way since then with the athletic department?
So me personally, no. And I actually like my role better being primarily with survivors. As you probably have met our CEO and Vice President Rachel and Rebecca, they are the ones who do consulting and have been working with LSU athletics as well as their Title IX office on sort of those culture change issues. For me, I like to separate it a little bit because I have no problem giving a lot of feedback on my end when it comes to how survivors are treated and support for survivors.
877-217-5757. It's a serious topic. I know many are victims and no victims, and sometimes are uncomfortable talking about it, but it's usually better to shed light on a subject like this than run away from it. David in Atlanta. David, you are on with Morgan LaMondre of STAR. Hi, David.
Good morning. You know, having a firearm in the household by far is a more threat to a family member than any burglar could ever be. I suggest people have good burglar protection and less firearms. And I can tell you, I was a union steward for the Office Workers Union, and there were many cases of abuse of my workers and sexual harassment. I can't imagine how women could work these days, based on my experience, without union representation by a good shop steward.
Do workers have people at the office like David, who was a union leader, speaking up for them, or is it often a case where they're out there by themselves?
I would say in Louisiana, it's often a case that they're out there by themselves. I mean, in Louisiana, for the most part, for all of our protections, we typically rely on federal law. Just it's been very difficult to get certain protections in Louisiana because we have a very big business lobby that typically, you know, opposes legislation where they believe it's maybe a mandate on businesses to do or not do something. And a lot of times we'll hear, well, small businesses don't have the ability to have an HR person to manage these things. And I mean, I think that's where people should work with organizations like STAR. We do offer some free trainings, but a lot of the, you know, there's other means to come to us, and we are experts in our field that could help small businesses with issues involving sexual harassment and misconduct.
Now, when we last visited with you regarding the LSU situation, I think those lawsuits had just been filed, and now Sharon Lewis, who still works at the department as a deputy athletic director, associate athletic director. She has filed suit in federal and state court, and it has given LSU a reason not to come forward and to testify before legislative committees who are looking into this. It's kind of gone away as far as front page news, but has the story really gone away?
Well, I'm sure the story hasn't really gone away. I will say that, so on my end, working with survivors and still having survivors that I represent through the Title IX process, I did receive a report, a Title IX investigation report, since the new interim Title IX coordinator. And I did reach out to them and said I was very impressed with the new reporting that they have done and mm-hmm. the investigation. I, in my prior experiences, had not seen something so thorough. So I was able to see some improvement there.
We'll spend a few more minutes with Morgan LaMondre of Star. We're back after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Morgan LaMondre, legal director for STAR, which is Sexual Trauma Awareness Response.
Yes.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. Jason in Jones Creek says, just wondering if the reason Representative White mentioned in the heat of the moment getting a gun was because she perceived the thought of losing gun rights seemed to be overriding the topic of domestic abuse. I wish it would have passed. And you alluded to that.
Yes, yes. I think that's pretty much what it came down to, is that people kept mentioning sort of unfounded reasons for why this bill should not move forward about dealing with guns, and the fact that this bill will cause more people to lose their guns. And just a lot of those fears were unfounded.
Okay. Now, DA Hiller Moore, East Baton Rouge Parish District Attorney Hiller Moore, is investigating this to determine whether charges will be filed against Melinda White. And, of course, in some other high-profile cases, notably the Blaine Salamone case, Hiller Moore recused himself. He knows a lot of people, has relationships with him. What would happen if he recused himself here?
Well, I think if he recused himself, the case would go to the Attorney General's office, which I would hope in this situation that there is no basis for DA Moore to recuse himself, because I think that if it went to the AG's office, this would become even more political mm-hmm. and partisan than it already has become.
Bill in Jefferson Terrace, you're on Talk Louisiana with
Good
Moore.
Morning. And I know we all have this, the plantation mentality is what I call it, really resistant to unions and anyone else's rights but the rights of the rich. Thanks.
All right. Well, that alludes to the caller earlier from David in Atlanta. Right now in workplaces, is there adequate representation in most cases if a person has a serious case of sexual misconduct, harassment, whatever you want to call it, and needs it to be addressed?
I don't think so. I mean, just being, you know, working with people who come and seek STAR's legal representation, a lot of times when we're helping people who are employees, their policies of their employer, they don't even have policies that adequately address what the policy is. And most of those places are supposed to, by law, have policies in place, have anti-sexual harassment policies, just because it's mandated by federal law. They have the requisite amount of employees, and they just don't even have adequate policies as they're supposed to have. So to really enforce things, I mean, yeah, it's pretty lacking when it comes to adequate representation for employees, because in the end, HR is really there about protecting businesses and sort of the liability of their companies. They're not there to protect the rights, per se, of the employee.
How do you see the LSU situation playing out? There was all this attention, and now it's tamped down. But as you stated, the story is still there. The issues are still there. How do you see it evolving?
Well, I think the lawsuit and all the other lawsuits that seem to be happening, those will take time. I don't know what the status will be like, or if, because there's one where they're trying to get class certification. That will take some time. But what I do see happening is there, you know, with the legislature, Senator Regina Barrow passed a power-based a violence review panel. And I think that will really help shape policies to where things that have happened won't be forgotten about. Sort of like in 2015 when the other bill passed and then it was like, okay, well, everyone's just going to do this. I think because of the panel that was put in place, there's going to be some systemic change. And I'm going to be an optimist and say, yes, things are going to happen for the better. I do see some things changing for the better in the future.
Well, it's always a pleasure to catch up with Morgan LaMondre, legal director for STAR the last 6 years, and we'll be calling again soon.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you. We're joined now telephonically from Great Britain by Jack Guinness. And for those unfamiliar with Jack, he's a man who is well-known globally, a British writer, model, presenter, founder and director of The Queer Bible. That's his book, and this is part of Gay Pride Month. He began his career as a model and starring in global campaigns for all kinds of brands, such as L'Oreal and Dunhill. And he is here to talk about his book, Essays from Famous People About Other Famous People. And good morning to you, Jack. Thanks for joining us from abroad.
Thank you so much for having me. London calling here. So the book is really exciting, but it's not just about famous people writing about other famous people. There are some great names in there, like Elton John and Olympian Gus Kenworthy writing about their heroes. But we're also hearing from those unsung heroes, like the activists that don't often center themselves or put themselves front of stage. And the really exciting thing about the Queer Bible book is that we're bringing all these people together and kind of giving them icon status.
And you have an essay about none other than RuPaul, a fascinating person.
Absolutely. I think when I was a little kid, I remember seeing RuPaul and Elton John. They released a single together of Don't Go Breaking My Heart. And I was a little kid, and I don't think I really even understood what RuPaul was. I definitely didn't understand that Elton John was gay. So I think I just assumed that RuPaul was one of his latest in a long string of girlfriends.
Well, you write that RuPaul inspired you to create the Queer Bible, to create something beyond yourself, something real, a platform for others to tell stories in their own voices, a space and community for the next generation who can joyously celebrate culture and educate us about evolving concepts of gender and politics. The world has changed, and it's changed in a big way in a short time. Are you amazed at how discussion and the acceptance has evolved in a relatively short period of time?
Absolutely. I've seen things change so quickly in so many ways. And I think for a lot of people that are maybe outside the LGBTQ plus community, these changes maybe seem a little bit alarming. They maybe seem that lots of concepts that have maybe remained the same in people's minds and hearts for a long time feel that they're being threatened or they're changing and they're evolving. And I can understand why that can be scary for a lot of people. And I myself, you know, I come to this very humbly as someone that wants to learn from other people and hear their stories and understand how the world is changing and people's ideas of identity and sexuality and gender are evolving. And, you know, they're evolving in different ways around the world. So it's exciting and it's scary and it's brilliant to see the evolutions that are happening. I think it's also easy to see that while a lot of positive things are happening, there's still a lot of work to be done. And as long as kind of young LGBTQ plus kids are being bullied or are committing suicide or are being attacked, that's where the real work needs to be done. So yes, there's a lot of positive change, but there's definitely a lot of protection that needs to be extended to the more vulnerable members of our community. And I'm in a very privileged position. And I hope that the Queer Bible, which is about sharing stories, realizing that, yes, we're all very different, but we also have a lot in common. And the things that connect us are deeper than the things that separate us. So that's the message I'm trying to get out through the book.
The man we're speaking with, Jack Guinness, was described by British GQ as the coolest man in Britain. You publicly came out years ago in The Guardian. What was the response at that time?
Yeah, it was very positive. I come from a very religious background. My father's a vicar, you know, like a priest, a Church of England vicar. So he looks like a character out of Four Weddings and a Funeral. And my uncles are all vicars. My grandfather's a vicar. My great uncles are all vicars. My great grandfather's a vicar. And all my great uncles are vicars. Our great great grandfather's brothers were vicars. So I come from a long line of religious people. So I knew that while I was coming out and identifying as part of the LGBTQ plus community, I was also speaking into a religious community as well. And I think that that's a very interesting position for me to be in, where I kind of, I understand the desires and concerns of both communities as I came from that. So the response was positive and overwhelmingly so, but also complex because of my family background.
877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Jack Guinness. His book, a collection of essays, The Queer Bible, has gained attention globally, and we're talking about it right here. If you'd like to join us by email, talk@talklouisiana.org. We'll also be joined in short order by David Floyd, who directs tourism in beautiful West Feliciana Parish. We're back after this brief pause for the news with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing. Some inclement weather in our community right now, so hope you're being safe, and we're glad you're listening here. And if you'd like to join us, 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Jack Guinness, the coolest man in Great Britain. His book is The Queer Bible, as part of Pride Month. And Jack, a listener, this is Hal in Monroe. Says he's familiar with your rather impressive wardrobe. Who makes the selections for Jack Guinness when you're out on the town?
Oh, great question. I wish I had someone doing it for me, but it's all me. Yeah, I dress myself. I wish I had a butler or a stylist, but I have neither of those two things.
You do it well. If you look up this man on the World Wide Web, you'll see what a stylish fellow he is. What's the key to being stylish without being ostentatious?
Absolutely. Great question. I don't like, I describe it as peacocking when someone's being ostentatious. I think it's all about having an effortless classic style, especially for gentlemen. And I advise my male friends that if you're not sure what to dress like, you need to find an iconic Hollywood star whose style you like, and you emulate that style. So someone great like Steve McQueen or Marlon Brando, and you base your wardrobe off them and just basically dress for you, but maybe through the prism of what that guy would dress like.
And did you model yourself after anyone?
I've got a beard, so I'm trying to think who that would have been. No, probably a biblical figure.
Well,
a caveman.
Yeah, well, I mentioned on this show, you never see a fat Jesus. And to be stylish, it's hard to be plump and to really look good in your clothes, isn't it?
I disagree with that. I think, for example, a beautifully well-cut suit can accentuate the good things, the things you like about your build, and maybe hide a multitude of sins. I think any size can look great. It's about the fit of your clothes, and most importantly, it's about feeling comfortable and confident. And if you feel comfortable and confident, you give out an attractive air.
Yeah, well, that's a very good answer. Very, your answer was better than mine. Now, back to the Queer Bible briefly. You have noted, despite being a son of Great Britain, that you were influenced profoundly as a young man by James Baldwin. And there is an essay in your book by Paul Mendez on Mr. Baldwin. What impact did he have on your life?
I think James Baldwin is one of the greatest writers that America's ever produced. He's such a nuanced, brilliant, fierce thinker whose ideas are backed up and reinforced by just the poetry and power and force of his prose. It's you know, we often get writers that write beautifully, and we often get thinkers that have incredible original ideas, but the power of those two things coming together. And his background is similar to mine, having a religious preacher father, and then trying to reconcile his identity as a gay man with that of his background. So personally, I'm very drawn to him there. But I think his books, his discussion of race and identity, what it is to be a man in America, a black man in America, and a gay black man at that, is absolutely fascinating. But more than that, He writes about what it is to be a human, and that is universal. And that's what I love about the Queer Bible. It's about how we're connected through our shared humanity, whatever your background or your identity might be. And that's really done through literature. And that's how we understand people that are different to us. You know, that's how a white guy from London can feel connected to James Baldwin in America, in a different country, in a different time. That's the power of literature, and that's what we're celebrating in the Queer Bible.
Well, thank you for joining us. It's good to hear your voice, Jack Guinness. The book is The Queer Bible, and you're a young man with many worlds to conquer, and we look forward to being present for your next venture. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you so much for your time. Take care.
Appreciate it. And joining us in studio is David Floyd, closer to home. He's in West Feliciana Parish, where he heads tourism, one of the most beautiful spots in the whole wide world. And this year marks the bicentennial anniversary of John James Audubon's life and work in your home parish. And you had a big celebration Friday, and there's more to come, an even bigger one in September, and hopefully we'll have you back. But tell us about the significance of Audubon to West Feliciana Parish, David Floyd.
Well, in order to talk about John James Audubon, you all have to kind of talk about the parish itself. We're the most unique parish in the state. We're the only parish that has the Tunica Hills in Louisiana. And the terrain is a low-S soil-based terrain, and it's full of ravines, springs, gullies, and it has the most unique flora and fauna in Louisiana. And it's also on the Mississippi River, so it's part of the Mississippi Flyway. So what's significant about all this is that John James Audubon, on June 18th, in 1821, came to West Feliciana because he was downtrodden. He needed money. He was missing his family. He really didn't want to continue his Birds of America portfolio. And he had received employment from a family, the Peary family, to teach their daughter. And so that's why he came to the parish. Yet, when he comes up to Bayou Sara and gets off the Columbus steamboat, he discovers this unique terrain full of birds and weird trees and things of that nature that he had never seen in Louisiana. And he walks 6 miles, Jim, from Bayou Sara to Oakley, now Audubon Historic Site, and it changes his whole perspective. He just becomes so excited. In fact, he sees 5 types of birds on that short walk that he had never known existed. And he ends up doing 32 birds at Oakley in his 3.5 months of stay there. And from 1821 to 1829, he is actually a resident of West Feliciana, or the Felicianas. And he basically does over 50 birds, bird plates in that parish.
Well, his legacy is immense, and as stated, this is a beautiful part of the world. And it is the most unique parish in Louisiana. And one of the reasons is that you have about 15,000 residents, and a third of them are prisoners.
That's true. We say we have 11,000 free people. It's a very small community. And the community is going through a transition. And one of the things that we have discovered about ourselves, because we are so unique, we are really focusing on ecotourism. And, you know, the people who used to go to pilgrimages and to reenactments and that kind of thing, all those are dying. And a good reason is that the new generation is not interested in old furniture or a house without a story. Or you've seen one reenactment, you've seen them all. And so what they're interested in is the things that you and I grew up with. Camping, birding, photography goes with birding. They're interested in gardening, but not estate gardening. They're interested in backyard gardens that they can use the vegetables and such in their cooking. They're also interested, believe it or not, in hiking and camping on the ground. And so this is what we have. And during the COVID time, we boomed with visitors. And they came from New Orleans, and they came from Baton Rouge, and they came from the North Shore, believe it or not, in Lafayette. And they were coming for the weekend, and they were on the byways. They were in the town for eating and such, but you would go to the old Tunica Trace Road, which is a 500-year-old road, and you couldn't get your car down the road because they were parked and going hiking in the Tunica Wildlife Management Area and Cat Island and such that degree. So we see it as a boom for us to really develop more opportunities for people to get out and bike and cycle and that kind of thing.
877-217-5757 if you would like to join in our remaining time with David Floyd, who directs tourism in West Feliciana Parish. And he and his group will have a major celebration come September 17th to be exact, the Saturday. And I know you're looking forward to it, but the preparation is well underway. You basically have it in place. What's going to happen?
September 17th and 18th, we actually have the first symposium on John James Audubon. You would think that would be a symposium on John James Audubon, the man. There isn't. Not in the world. So this will be the first symposium in Louisiana and really the United States dedicated to the life and work of John James Audubon and his compatriots. And so the symposium on the 17th will give you birding opportunities with ornithologists. 200 years later, where Audubon was actually working at Oakley in the woods, you can go and bird there with an ornithologist. They'll talk about the environment. And then that afternoon, there'll be field trips to historic cemeteries and sites in which Audubon would have worked at. And then Saturday is a typical symposium of his speakers. John Fortner is coming in from Paris, and he wrote the most recent book, Audubon in Louisiana. Danny Heitman, who we all know,
right,
wrote the Summer of Birds. He'll be there. And really what we're trying to do is look into the work of man and also his life. And then that afternoon, the Audubon Historic Site, the Friends of Oakley, are putting on a soiree on the grounds of Oakley, which you can attend as well.
Well, we'll see you in September, and it is a fascinating part of the world. And my friend David Trependall has introduced me to a 5-star restaurant in your community, The Saint. It's a pretty good place, isn't it?
It's very good. And we have had just a burst of new restaurants. And we have 1796 at the Myrtles. We have the Francis Smokehouse and restaurant there. We have one of the finest Mediterranean restaurants in the state. So come see us.
What's the Mediterranean restaurant?
It's you had to ask, didn't you?
We just know it's good, right?
We know it's good.
All right. Well, we'll get the name. I'm sure a listener right now can provide that. But David Floyd, congratulations. We'll talk with you again in a few months.
Keep Thank you, going. Sir.
We're back after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster, and we head down the stretch with one of our favorite guests of all time, Dennis Dale McLean, the man, the myth, the legend, joining us from the Motor City, where he was king of the world in 1968 and 69, two-time Cy Young Award winner, won 55 games in two seasons, including 31 in the magical year of 68, in which the Detroit Tigers were champions of the world. Good morning, Denny McLean.
Morning, Jimmy. How are you down there?
Doing well, and it's great to hear your distinctive voice. And before we get to Detroit and what's happening in the seasons of 68 and 2021 that are analogous, a listener noted that it's 50 years since the Washington Senators played in the year of 1971, the last year of the Senators, and three major figures in Major League Baseball history were a part of that team. The manager, Ted Williams, Denny McLean on the hill, and Curt Flood, who was the one who changed baseball forever by stopping the reserve clause. You were all part of that team in 1971.
Yeah, actually, Curt lost that lawsuit. And then the union, we were in the midst of hiring Marvin Miller, who was the big-time guy in the steel business and negotiated most of the contracts for the steel workers. So we hired him to be our guy to head further. And we learned so much from Curt going to court after court, appellate court. I mean, he did everything right. And we learned a lot of information from depositions and lots of subpoenas, that we got a lot of information that's the reason why we hired Marvin. And Marvin stepped up, and ladies and gentlemen, look behind you, because Marvin did all of this for Major League Baseball.
Well, at the height of your powers, you were the highest paid player in Major League Baseball. And what were you earning, Denny?
Oh, I totally, with everything, you know, accumulated, probably a buck and a half, $150,000.
And yeah. As you've noted, Clayton Kershaw gets that for a few innings of work now.
I think he makes $150 an inning, doesn't he?
Yeah. When you calculate it, it comes out to about that. And of course, pitchers don't throw as many innings as they once did, and because of that, the complete games are almost non-existent. Shutouts. It is remarkable how guys can make that kind of dough, and they're seven inning pitchers. If that.
You're absolutely right, and I see a little bit of change once in a while, but it doesn't extend itself beyond one or two games. So, I mean, I don't – until this commissioner – and I like this commissioner, by the way. I think he's done some good things. He's also done some things that shouldn't be done. I mean, putting a guy on second base for an extra inning game is – you know what that is? That's Little League baseball. I mean, that's high school baseball, whatever it might be. And then – in some cases, the high school I went to in Chicago, Mount Carmel, they don't put anybody on second base even in this era, and they just want to play ball. I think everybody would like to play the game again the way it was once played. But the only way you make up the difference, the only way you put it back in order, is by raising the mound and letting everybody do their thing. It will improve everything, control, quickness. It will do a lot of things for a lot of people.
But they like offense, and if you raise the mound, that's going to cut down on offense. So how would that happen?
I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, I don't know how much lower the batting average can be aggregately, with the both leagues. What is it right now, about 200, 210, 220?
Yeah, they're not hitting much, and, of course, they didn't hit a lot in the year of 1968 when you were the king of baseball and Carl Yastrzemski won the American League batting title, batting 301. He barely got above 300.
I'll tell you one thing, too, though. This was the late 60s, early 70s was the end of the era. When every club had some really good pitchers. Look at Cleveland. Peon, Sonny Siebert, Jim Harden, guys like
Sam
that.
Sam McDowell.
Sam, oh, my God, I forget Sam. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea culpa, Sam. He was, Sam had a little bit of a drinking problem. And we never wanted to face Sam in the second game of a doubleheader at night because you could not see the ball and you had no idea. The worst part about that is Sam didn't either. And, it was take one, see where he threw the last pitch, and then be prepared. I'll tell you, get hit with 100-mile-an-hour fastball. I'm telling you, it will ring your clock.
Was he the hardest thrower in the game at that time?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when he was sober, the guy, you could hear the ball. You could actually hear the ball. And what people don't realize, Jimmy, is that he had a curveball. Nobody had a better curveball in the history of the game than Sam did. It was about a 7-footer.
Oh, my.
It started above your head. And the catcher, Duke Sims, would catch it about ankle high. Mm-hmm. And he threw with pretty good velocity. So he had everything going for him, except he had an issue. And that issue just really wiped out a guy who should have won 300 games.
A listener notes, and I've just confirmed it, Clayton Kershaw, in a 14-year career, we're talking about the best pitcher of his generation, has 25 complete games. And in the year of 1968, Denny McClain, in one season, completed 28 games.
That's the part of the game I miss. I mean, 5 and 6 innings they play. managers take guys out with a lead in the fourth or fifth inning. They did it here a couple of weeks ago. I forget what team it was, maybe Kansas City. And 2 days in a row, at least 2 days in a row, they had two pitchers out there, and one went four and a half innings, four and a third, and got jerked off the mound. They took him right out of the game because he got in a little bit of trouble, leading by four runs, mm-hmm. by the way. And then the next game, they did the same thing. The guy almost pitched five innings, four and two-thirds. So, but what people have to realize, you got to pitch five to get a win. And I suspect that if this commissioner stays in, we will see a different kind of defined winner for pitching games. So I'm thinking they're going to come up with a four-inning rule.
My goodness.
And that the guy will get a win for four innings. I see it coming. It's just, and you know what? Here's the problem. They talk about how long the games are. Listen, they're going to be long. When you make seven and eight pitching changes in a game, they've never addressed that, Jim. They've never addressed that problem. And if they would just go back to the 16-inch mound, they will have solved the problem. Why is it that most of our games were under approximately 2 to 2.5 hours of ball game? And these guys are 3.5 at a minimum. Why is that? It's the mound. I'm telling you, it's the mound. And lack of experience. Nobody's sitting in the minor leagues anymore, you know, having spider races on the bench. So, you know, and you don't see many people spitting seeds anymore. Boy, those seeds used to really bother me.
A few weeks ago, we lost Mike Marshall, who holds the American League and National League records for most games in a season for a pitcher. 106 games in the regular season for the Los Angeles Dodgers in 1974, and then pitched, I think, in every postseason game for the Dodgers, who went to the World Series and lost in six games to the A's. He was a guy who believed that more work, not less, was better for a pitcher. He came up with the Tigers. You knew him pretty well. What about Mike Marshall?
Mike Marshall was there when Johnny Sain was there. Johnny Sain believed in throwing every day, but not hard. You know, you're not going to go out in the bullpen and throw 10, 12 innings of nothing but curveballs and sliders. You're just going to go out there and check the parts, the shoulder, the elbow, you know, the waist, the knees. That's all he wanted you to do was to just get into your rhythm, get into your windup, and just throw 50-mile, 60-mile-an-hour fastballs. And do that again in the second day, and you could throw a few more pitches, probably another 10 minutes if you wanted to. And then you would, and I'm talking about starting the week on a Monday and ending it on a Friday. And by the time Friday came up and it was your turn again, you were ready to go, and you didn't have any pains. You didn't have anything suffering. And if you did, you got to tell the trainer and let him know. But bottom line was very few people had sore arms, very few.
We got about 45 seconds, Denny. I wanted to get this in. A couple of listeners have asked about your organ playing, including Les in New Orleans. The big LD asks about you and the organ. Are you still doing it? And another listener notes that you did it on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah, I certainly did, and we're coming out of the box again in about 3 months.
You're going to be playing the organ for public consumption.
Yes, sir, absolutely.
And you still drink lots of Pepsis.
A lot of Pepsis and a lot of Twinkies, Jimmy. God, you know what? My doctor about 10 years ago told me, I can't believe you've lived this long, but you don't drink and you don't do drugs. Those are two good things.
Well, thank you, Dennis Dale McLean. The man, the myth, the legend, always a pleasure. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. Until tomorrow, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.